Warning, this podcast details firsthand accounts of graphic crime, as well as deeply disturbing emotional profiles, and may not be suitable for all listeners. Please proceed with caution.
Molasses Manifesto.
I used to do things sneaky, in a sneaky way. My mother, used to like rip up her clothes or something, tear a hole in her blouse or something. If she had lipstick or something, I remember they came in those little metal canisters, you know, they look like big bullets. They used to run out, turn up the thing so all the lipstick comes out, you know, her favorite lipstick, and then break off the lipstick and then turn it back down, there'd be nothing in there. And when she went to use the lipstick, there'd be nothing there, you know. This sounds like weird, but like, I want to explain this so people understand what I was going through, how I handled my emotions or anger, you know. That's very spiteful, you know.
A Molasses Manifesto production brought to you by Audio Up. You're listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. I'm your host, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley. Joining me is veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. This is Killer Tape, Season 1, David Berkowitz, a.k.a. Son of Sam.
I hope you die.
He confessed to being the 44 killer, ordered by a voice speaking through a neighbor's dog, carry out his bloody outrages against young pretty women.
I snuck up on him and shot him.
Berkowitz planned to use the revolver again and again until he felt police were getting close.
I wanted to help people. I wanted to be important to somebody, you understand?
David Berkowitz, 24 years old, found himself surrounded by police. Well, he said, you got me.
And now the need for a story. If not for anybody else, for myself.
Police say those words ended the biggest manhunt in New York City history.
I should spend my whole life here for what I've done.
Episode 3, The Phantom of the Bronx. Act 1, This is Soundview. As the Soundview neighborhood of the South Bronx made its way through the late 1950s and into the early 1960s, it started to change in dramatic ways. What had once been regarded as a mainly peaceful neighborhood comprised of lower middle-class Jewish and Italian families, in the early 60s started to earn a reputation for being rough and tumble, and by the time David entered school, it was known as an area where crime and violence were commonplace.
When I was a kid, I was in so many fights. I grew up in a tough area, and until I was about 15 and moved out of that neighborhood, that's all we ever did was fight, you know. I guess it's part of growing up, you know, you outgrow it.
You ever pick out kids smaller than you were?
Yeah, but then I also, most of the guys, I fought with my own age, and some guys that were older than me, you know, picked on me. It was like an equal thing. It was a deadly, vicious circle. We all fought each other, rolled on the floor. After school, it was always fighting.
Jack asks David if he ever took any malicious pleasure in beating up the younger kids.
No, because the beating was coming towards me sooner or later, you know. When the older guys would come over to me or my friends.
Fighting, it seemed, was just a part of the great circle of life in Soundview. And with that, David Berkowitz seemed fine. Being a big, lumbering kid, fighting was something he was good at. And through it, he was a part of something larger than himself. One of the guys, if you will. At least a little bit.
From the earliest awakenings of his conscious mind, he thought of himself mainly as an outsider. And he only made, it seems, token efforts to become part of any group throughout his life.
David Berkowitz had always felt different, from his inner sense that he was deeply and truly guilty, to hearing the news of his adoption at age 5, which confirmed for him this outsider identity. He had always been angry, and he had always felt apart from those around him. Fighting seemed a natural way to express that, and it just so happened that in Soundview, it was a requirement. So as it turned out, the hand fit the glove.
He was a bully and a kid who made it a point to antagonize other children so that they would attempt to bully him. Anything he could do to provoke a physical confrontation.
Fighting was a convenient way to collect the punishments he had begun to fetishize and seek out as often as he possibly could. Punishment was something he felt he deserved and was coming his way regardless. So as David figured it, he might as well do something to bring the punishment on sooner than later.
who was driven to provoke violence. And the violence was a way of being punished, of fulfilling that masochistic need of punishment for the malice that he knew he harbored inside.
Still, all things being equal, and duality being his signature trademark, he would later tell his psychiatrist when discussing his early days in Soundview that, quote, "I didn't want to fight. When I was a kid, I often got picked on for being Jewish. There were plenty of fights between me and the Italian guys, but they were the aggressive ones, and as a result, as a child, I was ashamed of being Jewish. When I was a kid and we played soldiers, I was always the German. I always wanted to be the guy that got shot down. When you play war, you know, the Germans always lose." End quote. There were plenty of other Jewish kids in the neighborhood, but the treatment David received from the Italian guys mirrored what he had long felt inside. So there's with the voice he chose to listen to, saying, quote, "I never felt Jewish. Whether I was in a synagogue or not, whether it was a holiday or not, I never felt Jewish. Rather, I rejected my Jewishness because of all the ridicule I faced in school. There were many anti-Semitic remarks. Those Catholic kids were always passing nasty remarks about the Jews. To be with the crowd, I had to rebel against my own Jewishness, but I'm not proud of this." End quote. In what can easily be regarded as antisocial behavior born out of the resentment caused by the news of his adoption, David Berkowitz began to reject Judaism. After all, he thought, he was adopted. Maybe he wasn't even Jewish in the first place. In that case, he could turn out to be, quote-unquote, one of the guys after all. And all this would have been for naught. It was a line of questioning he would often bring to Nat and Pearl. Quote, "However, back then, my adoptive parents assured me I was totally Jewish." End quote. Jewishness confirmed, at least for now, he continued to reject both it and his adoptive family by connection whenever he could. Later, he would recount maliciously breaking the matzah of his grandparents inside the packaging, so they thought it had been purchased that way. Quote, "They never knew it was me that crushed the products." End quote. I also remember as a child that I felt proud to hang around with the Gentile boys. When I hung out and played ball with the non-Jews, this caused my grandparents to get upset. My adoptive father's mother was always putting the Gentiles down, but I continued to befriend them and reject Judaism. End quote. And as for his adoptive family,
he viewed them as part of a tribe that he didn't belong to by virtue of his adoption and this inner sense he had had even before learning he was adopted, that he was really different from other children and other people he came into contact with. He wanted to belong. He was never part of it, and he felt guilty about circumstances over which he had no control.
But despite his early attempts to reject Judaism, it didn't earn him a free ride into the social groups he longed to be accepted by. And soon it would affect his studies and his life at school in general. Quote, "I hated school because I hated the kids in my class. They're laughing at me. Their ridicule. The fighting after school. The competition for grades and girls. Yes, I hated it. When 3 o'clock came, I ran home at full speed. Once I got hit by a car doing it." End quote. Shakily on track to at least try and fit in some way, an event would occur in 1962 at the ripe old age of 9 that would draw David Berkowitz even nearer to his death fantasy and even farther away from forming meaningful bonds with those around him. David Berkowitz got hit by a car.
He has very vivid memories of playing one day and running out into the middle of the street and getting hit by a car and knocked across the road and banged up pretty badly.
And I went flying. Car was doing about, I think, 30 miles an hour, I'd say. I was 9 years old. Well, now God was really mad at me this time, you know what I'm saying? Boy, I did something really bad.
Just as he had feared his entire life, this was proof positive that God had indeed singled him out and was coming to get him.
Were you hospitalized? Were you not unconscious?
No, I wasn't knocked unconscious. I went flying. I went halfway across the street. And I just rolled and rolled. It didn't hurt because I was in like shock. I was frightened because all these kids I knew from school were crowding around. It was in the middle of a big street in Westchester Avenue in the Bronx. And it's a big shopping area, you know. Place packed with people. You know, I'm lying there. I'm sitting upright, and the cops are around interviewing me, you know, and the woman that hit me, a middle-aged woman, almost hysterical, you know. I was more scared of her than anything, because she was, you know, she didn't know what to do. She was, you know, she didn't mean it was an accident, you know. And I don't know what the heck.
In a scene that could have only reminded him of what he had witnessed just a few years before, in 1958, when his grandfather had passed away, and he had witnessed the effect it had had on his adoptive mother, Pearl, he once again came face to face with the incredible power of death, and the effect even a brush with it had on those around him. And it wasn't just his fascination with the effect it had on the woman who hit him, it was the effect it had on him. This time, he was the star, and all eyes were upon him, absorbing every move. Moments before, he had been the magical, invisible Jewish boy, and now he had suddenly morphed into something different. A spotlight had switched on, and he was an instant celebrity for a handful of minutes. Lights, camera, police officers. He was the lead in a drama unfolding in the middle of the street, and all he had to do was get hit by a car.
This was a big deal to a young mind that I got hit by a car and I survived. He speaks of it in terms of being fearful. He seemed to find arousing. He got attention from being hit by a car and not just bumped and fall down, but knocked across the road, led to a sense of invincibility, even though maybe God was out to get him and sent a huge mechanical automobile to punish him. He was stronger than that. He got away with another one.
God had sent a car to kill him, and he had escaped unscathed. He had tempted the universe and lived to tell the tale. This was it. This was the ticket, the real thrill. The game was on, the rules had been set, and an adolescent David Berkowitz began to crave bigger and better stakes. The pursuit of punishment, mixed with the need to escape it and pull one over, began to dominate his young life.
I got to a point where I'd do something wrong solely to be punished, you know? You understand what I'm saying? It got to a point where I wanted to be punished. I never really liked myself. I hated myself. I was always self-destructive and convinced that God was watching me, you know, and ready to punish at the slightest infraction of the rules or whatever. I knew I could always do something and get my just reward, you know, sit back and happily receive my punishment.
The car accident had been a total success. It had served the dual purposes of providing him with the attention he craved while bringing him the punishment he viewed as his just deserts. But that's not all it did. It also gave him a concussion. And for anyone familiar with serial killers and the elements commonly thought to produce them, head traumas in the histories of violent offenders are often thought to be a key element in serial killer soup. The particular noxious components that are often found grouped together in the backgrounds of those who would later prove to be unusually violent. Head trauma notwithstanding, the car accident proved to be an epiphanous moment for David. Where death before had been listlessly hanging in the background, just out of reach, a spotlight always focused on others, he had now, quite accidentally, been momentarily able to swing its focus to himself, and not only that, but he had survived to do it again. Punishment and attention in an unusually delectable blend, he had received a serious taste, and now he was hooked. But getting hit by a car was far too unpredictable. There were literally too many moving parts. It was far too risky, and it was far too confrontational. Even at this young age, it just wasn't his style. So if he wanted to scratch that itch, David needed something different.
My whole life was set around punishment, and if I didn't get punished by my parents for doing something, then I made sure to set a fireman in the lots. You know, this was sure to bring on punishment, you know, because the fireman would have to come and extinguish the fire. You know, I was very malicious when I was a child.
Arson was the perfect solution. Easy to cause, easy to get away with, and in a highly congested area like the South Bronx, it certainly got everyone's attention and set the otherwise fixed gears of the neighborhood into motion. And it was sneaky as hell. Arson was the ticket, and David Berkowitz started early, from the age of 4, according to him.
I was about 4 to 12, 13.
David Berkowitz set every kind of fire he could manage, and he did it as often as he could, saying, quote, "I set hundreds of fires when I was a kid. Of course, I was careful not to tell anyone of my secret ventures into other neighborhoods to set fires and to share my almost precious and joyful acts of thievery with others," end quote. And for those of you keeping tabs, arson is item number 2 in serial killer soup, an incredibly common indicator, especially when as pervasive and prolonged as we see here. Scratch a serial killer, catch an arsonist. It's hard to say how many fires David set in this time period, but it was certainly a lot, with some numbers going as high as nearly 2,000, leading some to believe that little Davy Berkowitz was in fact the Phantom of the Bronx, a prolific arsonist active throughout the South Bronx in the late 50s and early 60s. Phantom or not, childhood arson is a pretty solid indicator of things to come.
At the age of 4, he began setting fires randomly. And this is one of the key indicators that something is amiss in a child's psyche. It's an indicator of serious problems to come later in life. It's one of the hallmarks of a psychopath. Serial killer soup again. Arson is another one of those ingredients that's often present.
The match was lit, the fire took hold, and an arsonist was born. It was his new passion, a secret little gift he could give to himself, a love letter to the world around him, detailing the anger inside he didn't yet have words for. It was simple, it was destructive, and it certainly sent a message. This is how I'm feeling. Burn it all down.
He's doing it to satisfy the urge of this fire again that's burning inside him, of his own confusion about who he is and where he came from, and why he can't break through this invisible barrier that he sees and continues to reinforce subconsciously between himself and the rest of human society. I'm sort of playing God. I'm kind of controlling something here. I'm creating something that the tribe has to react to again, creating chaos and thriving on the feeling that I have created a scene, I have caused confusion among people of the tribe.
Even at this young age, David had affected the environment around him and changed it, an environment he typically knew as immovable, a reality that certainly did not revolve around him. It was an environment in which he felt powerless. And now, with the flick of a match, he felt like the god he had always feared, dipping his hands into the universe and directing events. He liked how that felt. He liked it a lot. And he was pretty sure he could keep on doing it forever, as no one ever seemed to expect little Davy, with his boyish looks and innocent grin.
A young person who begins to take out their hostilities and angers, frustrations on society at a very early age, which I did, and who does this at the same time on a one-against-society basis, in other words, alone. Like, I used to go off alone and just do acts of vandalism and things. Nobody would ever suspect me because I don't seem the type. They would think a wild bunch of rowdy delinquents would hurl a rock through a store window or something, or set the trash cans on fire, the trash bin, you see. But when someone like me does it alone without peer pressure and does it frequently, there's something wrong there, not mentally, but emotionally.
Where previously he had been part of the pack, fighting with others and participating in the hard scrap culture of Soundview, now he was alone on a campaign to tear it all down. David Berkowitz had opened a door, and with that doorway open, stepped into the darkness to walk a desperately dark path into a secret identity that would serve as a home for his rage and malcontent for the rest of his life. A decision that would set a series of dynamics into play that would eventually engulf his soul, erasing all previous forms of existence. And the system that perpetuated and protected his behavior was succinct. His naturally innocent face and cherubic grin shielded his acts of violence, which were powered by his limitless rage, a rage that at this time was only starting to grow. And in turn, a state of self-imposed isolation protected the entire system, and through the combination of these factors and forces, the whole thing kept going. The stronger each side got, the longer it all could continue.
He's carving out a very secretive identity for himself that is going to eventually dominate little cherubic-looking David Berkowitz, who no one would suspect of being a monstrous creation in progress. And the monster that he's clearly aware of and whose development he's feeding. And to be part of a group or feel you're part of a family would detract from the interior identity that you're carving out as something totally antisocial, something that has to be hidden from the rest of the world in order to continue to grow.
Everyone has emotional outlets, you see, for anger. And people dissipate to build up angers or frustration, which everybody has from time to time, in different ways. Some people have hobbies, others let it be released through sports. Others are open and they're frank and candid and they tell everybody their problems before they let them go back inside themselves. And they're emotionally healthy people if they can do these things, you see. But when one person begins to keep the emotions up, begins to either suppress them or repress them, and they build up and they take it out in spurts of antisocial acts or something, you know, then there's something wrong there. A person needs some type of guidance, counseling, emotional, somebody who understands human emotions and can work with this person, find out what the problem is before it's too late. Not only too late before the person does any extreme acts of violence or anything, but before the person turns inward to themselves so much that they can't be reached. There's a limit to where people go. Once they develop so much distrust for society or something, then they turn inwards and they put a shell around themselves. Before that shell is fully developed, that's when you have to reach that person. That's usually in the younger years of life. When the person reaches adulthood, and has lived for so long with this, with the anger and sending it out by doing criminal acts or malicious acts, if they keep getting into the habit of doing that, then it'll stay with them their whole life. Which is what happened to me, basically. Ever since childhood, I was doing these things.
As David begins his journey into isolation and begins to slip away from those around him, his connection to the world becoming more tenuous, there were people outside the home who tried to reach him.
I remember in the fourth grade, there was the counselor, she was assistant principal, Mrs. Stiller. She made me her special monitor to give me something meaningful, and I did very good. She did that at the last half of the year, and I did very good and finished up the fourth grade, you know, reasonably good. She let me work like for an hour and a half just running errands around the school on my own. I carried this big wooden pass and all her papers. She used to tell me what rooms to bring them to. And this was like when everybody was in class, so I'd roam the halls alone. And I was on my own. I had a lot of responsibility and I enjoyed that. I couldn't wait to run as many errands as I could. So I felt important there, but it didn't last any length of time.
That seems to be the real key to your problems, was that the constant feeling of insignificance.
Unfortunately, it was, as the saying goes, too little too late. And David's positive experiences with the outside world in this time period aren't nearly enough to offset the wheels that have been set in motion within his own soul. And so, as he continues to grow into a disgruntled youth, he begins to cast his net of malicious acts wider into the world around him. But to that end, it's during this time period that he began taking his bike on long rides into the Bronx and beyond. He rode 17 miles north to Rye Beach. He rode 23 miles north to Coscop, Connecticut on US Route 1. He rode 27 miles north to Armonk by the Kinsico Dam, and once he rode 32 miles north to Tarrytown, New York. It gave him a sense of freedom, a sense of accomplishment, and a sense of superiority to go farther and further than the rest of the kids he knew. Kids, he believed, despised him. David Berkowitz had begun to make his rounds, which would later turn deadly, saying, quote, "Just me and my bicycle, we were a team," end quote. Act 2, One Mean Guy. As David set fires around the neighborhood in a one-boy effort to burn down the Bronx, he lit fires back at home for Pearl to put out, both literally and figuratively.
He became like a really bad, domineering, abusive spouse, even though he was a much younger adopted child.
Outside on the streets of Soundview, society was to blame. But inside, alone in the living room, his adoptive mother, Pearl Berkowitz, was the magnet for all his rage. His universe, comprised of one planet orbiting one sun, was a planet comprised completely of anger and hate. So he focused all he had on her. His way of asking her to endlessly make up for the circumstances of his birth.
After learning that he was an adoptive child and not part of the biological circle, I think he's subconsciously for sure, and perhaps even consciously, began to view this adoptive mother that he genuinely loved and depended on as an object to be manipulated for his own gratification. And you know, without overdoing Oedipus here, he still needed to dominate her and to keep her off center. And he did that by tampering with her cosmetics, by generally vandalizing her personal property.
I used to do things sneaky, in a sneaky way. I used to like rip up her clothes or something, you know. Tear a hole in her blouse or something. If she had lipstick or something, I remember they came in those little metal canisters, you know, they look like big bullets. I used to run out and turn up the thing so all the lipstick comes out, you know, her favorite lipstick, and then break off the lipstick. And then turn it back down, there'd be nothing in there. And then when she went to use the lipstick, there'd be nothing there, you know? There's a whole bunch of things. Like she'd be making something, and she'd walk away from the kitchen. She'd have a batter, like with milk or something. I'd put orange juice in the thing. You know, this sounds like weird, but like, I want to explain it so people understand what I was going through, how I handled my emotions or anger, you know? That's very spiteful.
He tore her clothes, ruined her favorite makeup, and poured orange juice in her recipes. He even killed a parakeet she loved named Pudgy. Quote, "It was I who killed him by giving him very small doses of kitchen cleaning materials that I found in abundance under the kitchen cabinet. After I started to put the poison into his food cups, within 3 weeks he was dead. My parents took him to the veterinarian, but the vet said he had developed some kind of cancer. They never brought the bird home again because they said it had to be destroyed. My mother never got another bird. I was jealous of all the attention he was getting. My mom used to spend hours messing with that stupid bird. She cleaned his cage and removed all his drippings. She washed his cage and constantly fed him. When I tried to touch him, he would always snap my finger. He was nasty to me. We both hated each other. When my mother used to spank me, she would talk to Pudgy, who used to have his cage in the living room, and tell him how naughty I was. She did the same thing with our dog Lucky," end quote. All of these feelings he harbored deep inside, and Pearl, to my knowledge, was never aware of how he truly felt. David went as far as to mourn alongside his mother in grief when the bird died. Like a junkie who helps you look for the item they stole from you, David committed to the role of innocence wholeheartedly, as any good actor would, childishly playing in a duality that would later become his trademark. Quote, "I never got caught, never. I left behind me, even when I was only about 12 years old, a trail of burned trash bins and burned automobiles. There were dead fish, all of which I killed, the dead poisoned bird, the torture chamber I created for ants, flies, roaches, and any other hapless insects who would have been unfortunate enough to enter my room, the vandalized apartment building with the yanked out elevator plates, the floods in the basement, the broken windows, and the can of paint all over the hallway. Not trying to brag or boast about these destructible acts or how I managed to evade capture, much less punishment, I only want you to know what occurred, see the signs, learn something," end quote. Not so sure I believe the bit about not trying to boast, but it does seem true that he was very seldom caught or sometimes even considered for his malicious acts. Quote, "I have often noticed just how unobservant people are. It's been said that parents are the last to know. This may be true in my case, for I wonder how I, at age 9, 11, 13, etc., managed to do so many negative things and go unnoticed. It is puzzling indeed, and I think you will agree it is sad," end quote. Good guy routine aside, and even though he might not have always been caught, It's not as if Pearl was completely snowed by David. She knew what was going on, at least on some level. Maybe not about the bird specifically, but in general, she definitely knew something was wrong.
He got the attention that he craved from that, and he needed a lot of attention. His entire childhood was built around acts of vandalism and violence for which he sought attention and punishment. And Pearl unwittingly and for, I think, the very best of reasons, wanting to be a gentle, loving, caring, nurturing mother, fed right into that.
He took her compassion and he used it against her. And at a very early age, realized he could manipulate her any way he pleased and take her for granted. When he maliciously broke his toys, she replaced them. When he begged her to buy him whatever he wanted in the grocery store, even though he knew money was tight, he threw a temper tantrum until he got his way. And when that didn't work, he stole. Quote, "I stole from my parents often, just nickels and dimes mostly. I'd rifle their piggy bank and my mom's purse. I always had plenty of candy money and money for baseball cards. I had a huge collection of cards, too. The most I ever stole was a dollar bill, but I stole those pretty often. She never knew if a buck was missing. She used to leave her purse in the kitchen. Carefully, without upsetting anything, I would remove her change purse and pull out a single dollar bill. Carefully, I would place the small purse back in the pocketbook, trying to place it in the exact same spot. It always worked. I feel bad about this. Sometimes I felt good when I got away with it, and I always did. I get pleasures out of my craftiness." End quote. David was honing his secret persona, and Nat and Pearl knew it. Nat's nicknames for David at this time included Sneaky, Snoop, and Spy. Quote, "I could never go to the refrigerator at home when somebody was around. When there was nobody, I would put food on the plate and sneak into the room and eat. No wonder my father called me a sneak and a spy. I used to spy on my father. I used to look at his face. Did he look clever or not?" End quote. Try as I may, I cannot get this image out of my head. David stealthily removing dollar bills one at a time out of Pearl's purse, careful not to disturb any other items. So patient, precise, and acting with such great malice. This is the behavior of someone who clearly takes pride, and maybe even a little joy, in what they are doing. It was clear that David Berkowitz took pride in his craft, and the art had many aspects. David acted maliciously towards those around him. He wanted to hurt people with his behavior, and for those actions, he wanted to get caught, and he wanted to get punished. But he didn't want to make any of it too easy. He had to be outdone. He had to be stopped. That was the game.
I don't know if he thought of himself as a saboteur, but that's essentially what he was doing, and I think, it was ultimately self-sabotage. He did that by attacking people closest to him, and particularly the mother that he supposedly loved. But at that time, he was so self-absorbed and confused that he was compelled to sabotage the very source of his life, pouring things in the food dishes that she was preparing, breaking apart the lipstick, and resenting the fact that he was dependent on such a trusting and loving person. The kind of person that he somehow knew he never would be.
It was though he felt he could destroy the goodness in Pearl by exposing her to the full force of his hate, and by doing so, could somehow validate the way he had always felt about himself. She was on the very inside of the fabric of his being, and hate was the only thing he had on offer. So he sought out opportunities to share that self-replenishing fountain of inky blackness whenever he could.
There's something called werewolf syndrome, how the werewolves are supposedly driven to kill the people that they love the most. He had this monster inside him that he was always, on the one hand, feeding, and on the other hand, trying to get a leash on. He was a sneaky, mean kid by his own recollection.
With things at home being the way they were, Nat and Pearl knew the situation was serious. They also knew that what they were currently doing wasn't working.
When you said you were tearing up her clothes and breaking up her lipstick and things like that, was that because you were angry at her for paying attention to your father? Was it that?
Yeah.
Did you ever tear up your father's stuff?
Yeah.
Kind of both. You think maybe if they'd foil the daylights out of you a couple of times, you might have got the message on that?
They did. They hit me a lot. But I deserved it. I'd be busting up stuff, you know. That's why, you know, after a while, the hitting got to be pointless. So they took me to the child psychologist at Mrs. Sosnoff I was telling you about. And because they didn't know what else to do.
Clearly something needed to be done. So they did what any reasonable parents would do. They sought outside help, and they arranged for David to start seeing a psychologist. Something I have no choice but to heavily applaud them for, as it was both outside the social norm in the early 1960s, as well as being expensive, which no doubt placed an extra burden on their struggling family. Act 3, Therapy.
Nate was, again, working minimum 12 hours a day to keep feeding the family and keep David in school and provide money for the therapy that Pearl was taking David to. Try to help him sort through some of these problems that by that time they had begun to recognize were serious. Nate was a hardworking, caring, but distant, typical American male. You provide food and shelter, and you allow a child to develop and nourish them in whatever way you can, with mainly financial and physical support. But it was Pearl who was young David Berkowitz's entire emotional support system. She was a clearly intelligent, perceptive, and caring woman who tried to do the right thing. She did everything she could to intervene and head off a problem that I think she must have foreseen about to happen.
Pearl may have been the instigator, but it was Nat and Pearl together that made it happen. David was their son, and he needed help, so they put David in the car and drove him down to Manhattan every week to see a therapist for what would end up being several years.
I went there for about 3 years to this woman in Manhattan. She was retired, and now she ran her own practice on the side of Mrs. Sosnoff, but she's not living anymore. She was in her 70s back then, and I heard she died. Her husband died. And she was a really kind woman, you see. She was wonderful with children, and she ran her own private practice, and I used to go there once a week. I'd go. And she'd ask me all types of questions and things, and she'd do it all types of ways for her to let me let out my hostility. She had all types of soldiers and things, and all these dart guns and things, and I'd be shooting at all the soldiers. Oh, it's unbelievable that this woman was really brilliant, you know.
Surprisingly, David seemed to enjoy therapy and took to it like a duck to water.
I remember him talking about actually enjoying the sessions with the psychologist, who I think he described as an older woman who was semi-retired. And here again, I'm sure the woman had good intentions, but her device for having him deal with some of the anger that he felt for the kids in the neighborhood, he mentioned a kid named Jeffrey that he was always getting into a scrape with. She put a toy dart gun in his hand and put up a little toy soldier or doll in front of him and said, here's the gun, and the gun is where your anger is, and that's the person you're angry at, and tell me what it feels like when you pull the trigger and shoot this doll. He said, feels great.
Clearly, the intent here was to have David confront and then communicate his anger. But it's difficult to ignore the connection between this childhood role play and the murders he would perpetrate as an adult.
Did she always set up the toy soldiers?
No.
Sometimes?
Most of the time she did. Other times she... we had a lot of talks, you know. She had milk and cookies for me, and she used to write things in her notebook. Maybe take tests sometimes. I hated that. But she did. Those typical blot tests, you know. What does this look like? The blots.
Fake blots.
Yeah.
Rorschach.
Yeah.
Why did stuff go into her?
I wasn't getting anything out of it.
3 years of therapy, and it wasn't working. It wasn't working, and everyone knew it. Frustrated and bewildered, Nat and Pearl put David back in the car and drove him north again to the Bronx one last time. Therapy had been their last hope, and it had failed. I can only imagine how they must have felt. They had desperately wanted a child, and once they had received one against all odds, they had struggled for years to do the right thing in a difficult situation and give that child what they thought he needed in order for him to grow into a functioning adult. Now, that was all over. It had not been easy for them on any level, and unfortunately and tragically, it had not worked. Alone, desperate, and seeking a solution that would both soothe the rage inside their child and bring some healing to their home, Nat and Pearl gave David the bedroom in their little one-bedroom apartment and moved into the living room. Historically, the Berkowitz had all slept together in the same room, with a little bed at one end of the room for David and a full-size bed for Nat and Pearl on the other. Now the bedroom was all his. David had always seen Nat as a rival for Pearl's attention and resented when Nat wanted to be alone with Pearl in the bedroom. Nat and Pearl were incredibly close and had what Berkowitz would later describe as a, quote, near-perfect marriage, end quote, a fact which he also seemed to resent. David had always had an overt curiosity about his parents' sex life and appeared to be jealous of these interactions. Every night after they had all gone to sleep, Nat would creep over to David's bed with a small flashlight to make sure he was asleep. If he wasn't, Nat would be angry, according to David. Being a curious boy of slightly above average intelligence, David surmised that these flashlight check-ins were on nights when Nat made love to Pearl, so he stayed awake, straining to hear. In order to quench his curiosity and continue his spy operation on the pair, David became a master at pretending to be asleep. Eventually, Nat bought a sleeper couch and Nat and Pearl moved into the living room, leaving David alone in the bedroom. And even that didn't work.
I think this was something which also symbolized in David's mind that he had won the Oedipal struggle. You know, he wasn't sleeping and being intimate with the mother he loved, and he had worked really hard to tear away all affection for her husband. But he now owned the bedroom where the real man of the house sleeps. This had to encourage his feelings of omnipotence, of being the de facto head of the household.
Pawn takes king. Now it's checkmate. Alone in the bedroom, the nightmares of his early childhood still plaguing him, David would get up out of the bed and go into the living room where he would wedge himself between his parents, much to the aggravation of his father. David seemed to enjoy being frightened. Quote, I used to watch horror movies on TV. All of them. Everything from Dracula to Godzilla. The other guys watched too, but I was bothered more than they were. At 11, you know, or 12, the monsters haunted me. I couldn't sleep. I'd have to leave the light on. Sometimes I'd run out of my room. I was so scared. Then I'd go sleep with my folks. When I had to do that, they seemed annoyed and angry. End quote. Later, he would weave these monsters into his own mythology. Quote, the monsters plan to take me over. Even when I was a kid, I'm almost certain that they're the same ones that got me later. Like they were with me. I think I was born so they could take me over, you know? End quote. All of this added up to a whole lot of restlessness, and it took David a long time to fall asleep, even on the nights he slept with his parents, due to Nat snoring. But at the same time, he took comfort in the sound, because it meant his father was still there, and he was terrified of being alone. Quote, this is very funny, especially if you could have seen it. But I used to tap and shake my father every so often to see if he was still there. Boy, did he get mad. End quote. David would later tell a psychiatrist that he remembers tormenting Nat to the point that his father locked himself in the bathroom where he then, quote, sobbed like a child, end quote. When this happened, Pearl, hearing the uncontrollable sobbing of her husband, rushed to the bathroom and started pounding on the door to be let in. She was terrified her husband might hurt himself. After a few minutes, the door opened and she entered, calming her husband's nerves. Recalling the event, David Berkowitz described himself saying, quote, I was a cruel monster, end quote.
What was the worst time you either were ever punished or the worst you ever felt like you were punished?
that my parents took the door off my room. That was punishment. I used to have, after I got a little older, about 11, 12, I lived in my own room. And my father, when I was being bad for a while, he took the door off the room so that I had to hear them talk all the time, and it annoyed me. I always used to love my privacy. I always liked to close the door.
Eventually, he got to them to the point that they took the door of his bedroom to prevent him from starting fires and maybe burning the apartment down or destroying more than he already was destroying. And that sort of broke down his need for privacy to develop into the person he was.
Next time on Killer Tape. David Berkowitz loses his only substantial connection to the universe when his adoptive mother, Pearl Berkowitz, dies.
I used to curse her out and say, "I hope you die, I hope you die." And then one day she never came back.
Thanks for listening to Killer Tape, the true crime podcast where killers and hardcore criminals tell their own story in their own words. Killer Tape is written and produced by me, documentary filmmaker Bill Badgley, as well as veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional writing and producing by Allison Baker. Executive producers include Jared Gutstadt, Jimmy Jelinek, and Phil Alberstadt. Research assistance by Olivia Pepper. Transcription services provided by Laura Klein Shaw. Editing and sound design by Molasses Manifesto Productions. Original score by Ben Von Wildenhaus. Artwork by Mike Gabriel. Killer Tape is based on 19 hours of audio recorded with David Berkowitz inside Attica Prison in March of 1980 by veteran prison reporter Jack Jones. Additional resources for the series include Confessions of Son of Sam by David Abrahamson, M.D. and Son of Sam by Lawrence D. Klausner. Special thanks to Christian Bernhardt and Shelby Shankman at UTA. Stay safe out there.